Welcome to Ever Beyond. Broadcast through the Wolf Spirit Media Network. Be prepared to leave your belief systems behind as we go beyond teachers, beyond gurus, beyond duality, ever beyond. Please join us in the chat room at www.wolfspiritradio.com/listen. You're listening to Wolf Spirit Radio.
So, here we are. Thank you very much. This is Wolf Spirit Radio. It's the 21st of May. It's 23 hours and 3 minutes in the UK. My guest, hey, where are you, James?
I'm in Mississauga, Ontario, Canada.
Ontario,
is
in Canoodia. Oh, yeah. More Canoodians. It's very nice, because you know I'm half Canoodian myself.
No, I didn't know that.
Yeah, my surname is Perron, and it's very popular in Montreal.
Ah, yes. I'm going there soon. I can't wait to go there. I'm going on a holiday with the family starting July 15th. We're going to Montreal, Quebec City, the East Coast, New Brunswick.
You will see innumerable numbers of Perrons.
Nice.
It will freak you out. You'll say, that guy, JP, why does he call himself P? Because Perron in Montreal is like more than Smith. For some reason, it's the only place where the Perrons is. It's the home of the Perrons. And I only went there when I was 6 years old in 1967. So, it's been a while.
Wow. You were there in 1967. That would have been the place to be in Canada in 67.
Oh, yeah. Well, it was the Expo Fair.
That's
and
right.
And they had, I have very few memories of it myself. I was probably abducted or something. But anyway, but I do remember this big geodesic globe that they had. You know,
okay.
It was a great big sphere made of triangles, you know,
cool.
Geodesic dome, but a sphere. And they had a monorail, but I don't remember being on the monorail. But anyway, there we go. There we go.
Nice.
So my guest tonight is somebody other. Here's the background to this, James. The other day I was listening to the first show that it wasn't the first show, but Sam Mowat, you and Adrius did a show on Dave Scott's radio program, Spaced Out Radio, and
that's right.
It fascinated me because what I felt was, now, this James guy, he's not saying very much about himself, but he's saying a lot about himself, if you see what I mean. And
oh, yeah.
I thought, I think I need to pull him out of a round table and talk to him on his own. Because you got some stories, brother. And there's some stories of tragedy and the stories of triumph. So tell us about what you want to tell us about. And then we'll go back and talk about some other stuff that we're connected with. You know, tell us a bit about how you got here, James.
How I got here?
Yeah.
Okay. All right, this will freak you. Well, okay, I'll just say it like it is.
Say it like
I have
it is.
A memory. I have a memory of me being in a foggy, hazed-out room. And I was talking to three beings, and I couldn't really make out their faces. And anyhow, I was a little bit pissed off because I was taken in for a meeting and I was expecting one thing and it turned out I was getting another thing. So I wasn't too pleased about that. And one of the beings said, look, we have another job for you to do. And right then I said, look, I've done enough jobs here. I'm done. I want out. And they said to me, well, you know what? Before you say that, have a look through the viewfinder and see if you like what you see. So I said, all right. So what it was, it's just like it's almost like a submarine scope.
Periscope, yeah.
Yeah, that's right.
Okay, so you got a periscope on a future possible life.
Yeah, so what happened was I was looking down this, what they called a viewfinder, and the viewfinder, you can zoom right in on Earth from above, and not only can you see it, you can hear it. So here's the trick. I was born in 1967. So I guess this happened early 67, because I would have to be incubated in a womb and stuff like that. But what I was looking at was, I was looking at a park somewhere in North America at a group of early 20s kids. I guess you would call them hippies.
Oh, no, they gave you the hippie demo. And you thought, there's a good place to go. Yeah, fine. Good idea.
Oh. And you know what? I loved it. I heard the Beatles for the first time on a UFO, and they were playing it on the radio, because back then the Beatles were every third song was the Beatles being played on the radio anyway. And then I seen them. They're all happy. The vibe was really happy. And I said, what an incredible place Earth's become. I said, okay, I'll go back down there. And next thing you know, I remember being born and being in an incubator, right? And out popped me, right? But I believe I was on a spaceship, and that's how I ended up here in this incarnation in this lifetime.
Wow. So basically, they tricked you back in there.
Pretty much, yeah.
Bastards. I mean,
but in a good way. Like,
I know. But to get, I mean, you know, because when I say to get here, I mean, when I'm speaking specifically about this present moment.
Yes.
And, it's interesting how people answer that question, you know, cause like, you could say, well, I worked all my life and all this, you know, but no, it's interesting. You said, this is how I got to this planet. And can you recall if you look down at your feet when you're on the ship?
No.
What they look like?
I don't have any memories of feet. Or faces. Actually, I remember looking at the beings, but their faces were all fogged. I don't know if they were actually female or male, believe it or not. And the one thing I did notice, though, they were wearing kind of like gowns, right? It wasn't robes, but it was very close to a robe. But it was more or less like a really comfortable, loose sweatshirt that was actually it made as like a shirt and pants, right? Kind of cool looking, actually. Okay. Very comfortable.
All right. So do you remember the texture of this material? Was it soft?
It was very flowing. It was whitish, right?
Mm-hmm.
That's about all I remember, right?
Okay. So there, you were also in the story implies that you've been on other missions.
I guess it would, yes.
Yeah. And that you were kind of getting a bit tired of going on missions and you wanted to go back home.
I really was, yeah. That
and time. Where's home?
Well, I believe it's the Pleiades, my friend. But here's the catch. I don't believe I've been on the Pleiades ever in my lifetime here. I believe I came from old Lyra, but I haven't been to new Lyra or the Pleiades star system, as you would call it on Earth, right? So that's the thing.
Here's the thing. There's
stuck for like 280,000 years, mm-hmm. reincarnating. And then when I finally thought I got there, I've ascended. I'm on the ship. Wow, here I am. And then they hit me with this other mission, right? It's like, wow, right? But I liked what I seen in 67, right? If it would have stayed like it was in 67 up to around 70, I think times would have been a lot different than it is now on Earth.
Well, here's the thing. One of the feelings that I have is that the 60s were those, you know, the love energies of the 60s.
That's right.
They're the pre-waves of the Aquarian Age. It's
for sure.
It's like that, but they're trying to clamp this big kind of iron thing over us to make it feel like we're in this big new world order. But it's actually much more flowing than that. And people are really chilling out and getting it, getting the idea of, hang on, we don't have to be like this. It doesn't have to be this way. And so, you know, there's this feeling that the establishment put a real kind of clamp down on the 60s and clamped down all these hippies, which is a complete illusion because the hippies just evaporated and recondensed elsewhere. Because the hippies are the starseeds, and the starseeds are you and me and all the other trapped Lyrans and Pleiadians that have come here. Now, here's my thought as to what the plan might be.
Okay.
Is that we pepper, you know, we pepper into reality here on Earth with a kind of wake-up program frequency detector thing.
Mm-hmm.
And when the frequency comes to a particular point, we start turning on, and instead of being who we thought we were, out starts coming this other being who is really who we are. And it's a bit like, you know, it's the caterpillar, turning into the butterfly kind of thing.
Kinda, yeah. I think you have, you're getting something. I think you're getting onto the cusp of something that, could very well be true.
So, now one of the things that we, you know, a lot of us, you know, people who've woken up a bit, see the rest of the world, and everybody's like walking around in sheep and asleep. And here's my assertion is that it's okay. It's all going to happen in time. And we need to have enough people who are waking up gradually to eventually have enough people that we can buffer the shock of the mass awakening. Because by that time, we'll have enough of a telepathic network so that when people do wake up, they're not waking up into a chaotic vacuum. They're waking up into, oh, something's already here. Hello. Welcome, new friend.
That's right. We need a lot of counselors, people like that. That's going to be a really valuable resource. And you know who makes the best counselors?
Warriors. People who have been traumatized.
Well, that too, but poets and musicians.
Well, they have a heart. You see, it's all about having an open heart. No.
That's true. And I think they could be real ambassadors to this new concept, right, of peace, love, and happiness.
Well, you see, everybody's got their part. And, yes, harmony is the thing that musicians can offer us, the understanding. I mean, natural musicians have a natural understanding of the geometric reality of harmony. You know, it's like astrology. It's just all geometry and you know, triangles and squares.
Oh, you got that right. There was a guest you had on the show. She was talking to Audrey a long time ago. We got to get Audrey back on the show, eh? But her name was Evie, and she's from Germany. And I'll tell you, like, I've heard a lot of music and rock and roll and stuff like that, and folk music. I'm a big fan of Donovan, right? But when I heard Evie sing, wow, right? She sort of melted my heart, right?
Oh, that's what you say.
Oh, she is. It doesn't happen too often when a musician can melt your heart, right? And when it does happen, it's amazing, right? And here's a person that's, she's not really an accomplished singer or musician like she should be or could be, but she's the one that actually did it. That actually melted my heart. Now you can look at a lot of other people, but they haven't had that same effect on me, right? And it's funny, right? It's like the unknowns out there are the real masters, right?
It's, you never know who you're talking to. You know, that's why they say, you know, you should be loving to everybody because you never know. You may be talking to a saint. You might be talking to, so I was just thinking about, what's that film? The Golden Child, when, Eddie Murphy walks along the street and he sees this beggar with one eye and he's all ugly and all that stuff and he treats him crap. And, okay. Then he meets this really beautiful, gorgeous woman and she brings him home to dad. And guess who he is? He's that same guy who was playing the tramp, who's actually the sensei, the master of the monastery.
Okay.
So you never know who you're talking to.
That's true.
So,
there's something you said about that as well. I'll tell you a bit about my personality. It's not like I planned this. It just kind of happens randomly like that. If I see somebody in need, my first instinct's to help the person, right? Like I remember driving down the road, a pretty busy street in a suburb of Toronto, and there was a guy lying on the road. He's fallen off his bicycle. So he's halfway on the road and halfway on the curb. And everybody's just going around him, right? So by the time I got to him, I got in the lane that he was actually in, threw on my flashers, stopped the car, and got out. And I said, buddy, you okay? He goes, no. I said, what's wrong? He goes, I think I broke my hip. And I go, holy crow, right? So then, because I parked my car and I blocked traffic, I guess more people in that lane started, you know, getting out of their cars. And we finally managed to get this poor guy onto the, off the road, number one, get his bike off the road, and then we called for an ambulance, right? But what got me, JP, was it was a straightaway, so you could see probably, you know, a good half a kilometer down the street. And you could see something ahead of you, like, what the hell's on the road, right? And all these cars that passed him, there must have been at least 300 cars that passed him before me. And nobody stopped. This is what gets me about society sometimes, right? So I was the one that stopped, okay? So I'm just saying that's just me, right? But what got me was I couldn't believe no one else did that. Like, where's the empathy sometimes too? This is what we got to bring the world towards, is empathy, right?
Absolutely.
Like many, many light workers talk about being telepathic, all right? Well, I'll tell you, it's like going to school, all right? And, you know, so you got to progress from kindergarten, grade 1, 2, and 3. I'll tell you what I feel. I feel if you don't have empathy, you're going to have a tough time being telepathic because it's all tied in, right?
Well, it's all about the heart, isn't it?
Exactly.
And, being able to, open up and hear and speak and to be heard, when, you know, you can get two or three people to do that, you know, that's when the magic starts happening. Two or three people who are actually intent on listening to each other. That's what causes the magic. And that's why, that's why the radio show is magic, because everybody's sitting, listening, focused.
Concentrating, yes,
and that's an energy. That's a morphic resonance.
Yeah, for sure it is. Right now, don't get me wrong. We all have bad days. There's times where I get up on the wrong side of bed too. Sometimes, right? And but you know, even though when I get mad, sometimes I throw it in the jokes. Right? I joke around. Right? I'm kind of masking my anger, which is actually leveling me out. And I don't even know that I'm leveling myself out through laughter, through being a clown, right? Which is kind of cool, right? Just little tips,
it's,
I guess.
Yeah, well, it's often a way to, pop the bubbles of tension.
Yes. Yeah.
It's a thing. It's a thing, isn't it? It's a thing. Yeah. So, I mean, one of the things, I've been, looking at so this is where I came to it. A few months ago, back in, when was it, July, I had an experience, and that experience, put me into a feeling, and that feeling brought me all the way back to the Lyran invasion by the Dracos.
Okay.
And through feelings, I remembered it all. And this is something that I've heard you talk about as well. You remember it through the feelings. And that I remember how I decided I was going to do something about it. And me and a group of other people decided they were going to do something about it. Then I realized, if I was there, what I would do, if I had that feeling, I would find a place where I couldn't where there weren't any reptilians for a start, where you could be, you know, kind of take a breath. And,
sure.
and then we could regroup and retrain and, you know, recreate ourselves so that we could be, up to the challenge of it. And, so we decided that the best place would be in the future where there are no more reptilians. So we used time travel to travel forward in time. And then we started inhabiting the Pleiades.
Mm-hmm.
So then after that, once we'd done it, we did an operation or two. And one of the operations was the destruction of the base on Maldek and also Maldek itself. And okay. That's part of this solar system's history. So there's that. Cause I've been trying to explore all the different, aspects of what all the Lyrans have done. And I think, right. Okay. So that's where I feel that I've gone. And when I look up at the Pleiades, I feel that that's home. And there you're saying, well, you look at the Pleiades, but you don't feel that you've been there. Yet you feel Pleiadian.
Right, exactly.
So does that shed any light on these feelings of yours?
It does, in a way. You made a good analogy there, which is something that could very well be possible. Like, I've heard Audrey talk not a lot about it, but he says about different timelines. We've talked about timelines in our personal conversations. And I've shared some dreams, which is what me and him also believe are different timelines. When we dream, we're actually living another life on another timeline. And so we talk at length about that. And there is, it's possible to time travel. You know, it's funny, JP. About a month ago, I interviewed this guy, and it totally happened randomly. His name is Bruce Beach. An old guy. And I found out he was an old American that used to be in the military, ironically. And he's been living in Canada for about 3 decades. And what makes him famous is he built a bomb shelter in Ontario, the province where I live in. And he did it out of school buses. And he had a lot of problems with the governments about this, but he just went ahead and did it anyway. And now it's in and it's done and they can't do nothing about it. And I wanted to interview him just on that fact alone, or meet him actually.
Sounds so, like a character. Anybody yeah. who would take a whole load of buses and make something. Well, did he like bury them all and make a kind of underground complex?
Yes. He took about 80 school buses.
Holy crap. I'd love to do that. Or I'd love somebody to do that and I could live there.
Yeah. He did this and, now the day I went there, he's about 80 years old, so he's up there in age, and it started drizzling. It was real Scottish weather, right? And so we couldn't see the bomb shelter, but that was okay too. Like it is what it is, and we agreed to come up another time. But he all of a sudden started talking about all these other subjects that I had no idea I was walking into, but I loved it. Right. I was like impressed. I was okay. I know about that. Yeah. Okay. Right. And then before you know it, I said, well, look, buddy, I said, do you mind if I tape you? Like, you know, and we'll put you on YouTube or something. He goes, yes, by all means. I said, okay. So he rambled on for about 7-8 hours and I had to pause and they had camera problems and there was a lot of interference, but I got a bit of it on tape and I'm going to go back and see him. Now here's where it gets interesting. He started talking about time machine or time travel. And then as he's talking about time travel, I'm looking at him. I'm physically looking at him. And of course, when you say time travel, the first thing that should pop in your mind would be the French writer Jules Verne. And as I'm looking at him, I'm going, geez, I said, this guy's got a beard. He's old looking. He's, you know, he's got the physical appearance of a Jules Verne. And then I started joking with him, like your name's JP, and I'd say Jules instead of JP. And he would look at me and kind of hesitate, which kind of did something with his eyes, like saying, okay, like try to mask something. I said, okay, this is interesting. And I did it numerous times, and every time he reacted, it's like it was his name. And then I even joked with him, and he kind of just played it off. Anyway, here's where it gets even more interesting. The guy was talking about time travel, and he says, look, they did a machine. They actually made a machine in the 1800s, and it worked. And he goes, not only did it work, it went ahead in time, but it can only go ahead in time about 100 years. And then they can only use what was within that 100-year range, or so he claimed. And then I'm looking back, and Denny's telling me more about his life. The guy had a submarine. He was one of the only civilian people in the world to own a submarine. He also had a 350-foot yacht with a crew of about 50 people. And I said, okay. I said, this is interesting now. Jules Verne, 20,000 Leagues Below the Sea, wrote a book about that. He wrote a book about being shipwrecked on an island. There's the beach. This guy's name is Bruce Beach. He's beached, right? So you got ships, submarines, time travel, all these things Verne wrote about. And then I said to him, I said, okay, so what were you doing with a submarine and a yacht? And he goes, well, he goes, I was a self-made millionaire three times over, and I lost it, gained it, lost, and I gained it all through the stock market. And again, it's like, okay, well, if you were a time traveler, you would probably know what stock to buy, right? Before it became a high price. And we kept on taking smoke breaks, because I was with a few friends, and we kept on talking about all this. I'm saying, I really think that. And all my friends were saying the same thing. Yes, it makes sense. It makes sense. And so anyway, we went back then, and he says to me, we're talking more about this, his ships and submarine they owned. And I said, so what prompted you to have all this? Like, what were you going to do with all this stuff? Like, you sound like you're Jacques Cousteau or something like that. And he goes, well, sort of. He goes, I wanted to find some treasure. And I said, okay. I said, so whereabouts was this treasure? Now, he mentions a Gulf. He didn't say Gulf of Aden, but he said somewhere close. And I think he was masquerading what he said for the real Gulf of Aden. Because as you know, a few years ago, there was a lot of rumors going up on the Gulf of Aden that there was some kind of portal there. And all the countries in the world sent a lot of ships there.
The big Stargate story, yes.
Yeah.
Have you got any more intel about that? Because there was a total blackout.
No, none whatsoever after that. All I remember was all the countries sent their ships, and that's all I knew, right?
Did any of the ships come back? There was a big ring of them, wasn't there?
It was a big ring of them from all countries. China, Germany, France, America, Russia. Everybody was represented.
Yeah, there was I think it was a Blackwater ship that, you know, didn't belong to a country, belonged to a corporation. That's right. How bad it was. You know, that they've come out and, look, we are a country, you know, we're a thing. We're more than a person.
Yeah, that's, I know. That's sarcastic and hypocritical. But no, but I hear you about that. But anyway, this guy freaked me out because of this time travel business. And then, of course, you heard the stories from the Art Bell days about this guy named John Teeter, right, who claimed to be a time traveler, right? Now, back in those days, I always, you know, I was kind of skeptical too. So I said, well, it's nice to, you know, have an open mind, and that's kind of interesting. But when Art Bell had Teeter on it must have been about 15 to almost 20 years ago now, he said some things that back in the day was eye-opening things. I can't remember really what they were, but it made a lot of sense now looking back on it, right? And you would only had to know those things if you're actually living these times, right? So you got the Jules Verne, you got time travel, you got all this stuff that Blackwater does and stuff like that, and Stargates. it kind of makes a lot of sense what's going on behind the scenes, just on Earth alone, right? So now when you mentioned about your analogy about the Pleiades, right, and the Lyrans, well, gee whiz, they're like, you know, a million years ahead of in technology than us. So I don't know if it's a million, but it's quite ahead. They probably have a lot of toys in their arsenal too, right? Because they're so much far advanced than us with our technology.
Well, yeah, but at the same time, you know, they went, it's so complex, right? So from our perspective, right, it's complex, but from, if you look at it from another, from the, anyway, look, let's stay with, what is it, FPV, point of view, right?
Yeah.
Okay, so, you're in Lyra, and then you go forward in time, way forward in time, like a billion years. Right.
Okay. Yeah.
Until there's no more reptilians. You look around, no more reptilians. Okay. Number one, that's good news.
For sure.
Yeah. Because at some point there were no more reptilians, right? Good. You know, so at some point they finished. And dimensionality is different and stuff like that. You know, because you raise up dimensions. So there's obviously a point when the dimensionality prevents the reptilians from moving forward. So, The Pleiadians move forward into that higher dimension future time. And from what I can understand is that this is where all, you know, the idea of human super soldiers must have come from. Because we built ships that had, parts of our consciousness in them, but they were still mechanical ships. They absorb, technology from the Greys, who are also, I believe, a future version of humanity.
There's scenarios about that, yeah, that the Greys are us, but in the future.
Yeah. I think that the Greys are the ones who accepted transhumanism.
Right. I think you might have something on there, right? Because I didn't hear it from one source either. And I can't prove that, but I know, there's a lot of people that actually seen Greys, and those who have been abducted by Greys have a lot of issues. Some of them don't, but some of them do, right?
So this is what, so let me share with you how I got into this, right?
Okay, cool.
All right, because I was here, I was just an ordinary guy, right? I was an IT guy, but I like music, and so somehow all together, and then somebody said, oh, you got a nice voice. So I thought, all right, I can do voice work and voiceovers and things like that. Anyway, then I did some radio with my girlfriend at the time, and she wasn't that good, but I seemed to be better at doing the radio anyway. She's a great singer.
Right.
So, you know, I moved on from then, and then somebody recognized me in a festival. They said, oh, yeah, right, are you Gary? Oh, right, yeah. And like, how did you know? Oh, I recognize you from the radio. So that experience was like, oh, it's come round. I need to address this. You know, something had come right round full circle.
Okay.
Somebody actually talks to you in the street because of that. There's something that anchors, you know, the first time you go to, say, a conference, and you meet people who have been listening to you on the radio, that's the point when the circle comes and kind of completes something in you.
That's right.
Anyhow, so all right, okay, so radio is my destiny. It all fits, you know, I've got all these skills. So anyway, but in 2011, I got a reading, and it was a tarot reading, and we were friends, and I recorded it, and it was a great reading. And I said, okay, well, how did I get to this planet? You know, it was like the last thing, you know, I've been doing other past lives and things like that. Okay, go all the way back. Where did I get, you know? And I don't know what I was expecting, but I certainly wasn't expecting this. She said, oh, they left you behind. Oh, they blew up a planet. Oh, they came from the future. Ah, through the sun. Huh? They blew up a planet. There's water everywhere. Oh, you landed here. You were looking for these bad guys. Oh, they left you behind. They went back to the future. It's like, oh, really? So what the hell is all that about? I don't know. That's just a story. All right. So I got this story and then I thought, well, that's interesting. Time travel through the sun. I'd never heard of that.
Okay.
And then, you know, I started watching Stargate.
Then, yeah, good show, by the way.
Yeah,
good show.
The best, you know, some of that. I got such a great reading list. But it's all TV. And then, somebody said, I told this story to a friend and she said, oh, you should listen to Michael Tesarian. I said, Michael to who? Michael Tesarian. He's half Hindu and half Irish. Amazing guy. And he has read through the Vedas, these ancient, ancient books that go back telling stories that happened long before Atlantis and Lemuria.
Right.
And this story of the destruction of Maldek is in this book. And it talks about people coming from the sun, from the future, destroying a planet and, you know, all these other things. And it goes on and it goes on and it goes on and it goes on through John Dee and the military industrial complex and the Anunnaki trying to get back off the planet. And this is who we, you know, and now we realize who the bad guys are, is these regressive reptilians. So here we are. So I was part of this force that was trying to stop these guys, and annihilate them completely. Obviously I've completely failed in that, but at least,
right.
I'm here. I'm here to say, hey guys, guess what? When they ate us all those millions of lifetimes, they would murder us and eat us. Our DNA would eventually tag them. So they glow in the dark.
Okay. Yeah.
That's, and I thought, you know, and this is what I've worked out over the last few years is that all of these higher humans, all these Lyran based humans who have been eaten by reptilians, they've tagged the reptilians.
Okay.
So now it's time to pick them all up. It's going to be easy to extract them, to find them. They're all marked. Which is what they didn't like, because of course they, you know, if they're marked, then they can't be hidden and they can't do their nefarious little deeds.
Exactly. And also in a situation where, there could be a possible, let's call it, I want to keep this upbeat, so I'm just going to say it really quick, but it's just a scenario that may or may not happen. Okay. So hopefully it may not happen and we can move on and live a life of dreams. But in an event of a nasty situation, because of our auras, our psychic resonance, which can be seen from space apparently, just our glow, our auric glow, identifies what star group we all came from. So you heard of the term when they do the roundup or when they do the rescue missions, if there are one, right? Each of the alien types know who to beam up on their ship, right? And make an evacuation if there need to be one, right? But at the same token with the reptilians, you would know about them. Now, here's another thing for you. I, like one of the, your guests there that you have that I am fond of, because he's very eloquent in the way he talks, and he's a very pleasant personality, is Simon Parks. And Simon Parks, of course, you know, he said he's got some insectoid in him, right? And I know a person here in Canada, major abductee, he's an experiencer more than abductee, but he has been abducted. And he's been abducted by these insectoid beings as well. His name is Paul Shishi. And there's two people I know. Well, I know Shishi. I don't know Parks, but I heard of him. They're not too bad in personality. They're not a heartless person. They have a heart, and they talk through empathy. And they actually talk good about intentions of Earth, which is a good thing. So insectoids, those two, they're all right, right? They're actually pretty good. And I've asked Audrey this too. I said, look, I said, you know, isn't there going to be one day where we can all live in peace? right? Like that song, Live in Peace. And he goes, if we take one element out, yeah, it could be done. And then I heard, that guy Kramer, Randy Kramer, I heard it on Mars. I think it was, no, actually it wasn't Kramer. It was, Tony Rodriguez. It was Tony Rodriguez that said this. And Rodriguez said on Mars, which he claims to have served time there as a slave, everybody gets along more or less, right? But everybody doesn't like the Draco. Reptilian don't like the Draco, insectoid don't like the Draco, human don't like the Draco. It seems to be the Draco that everybody just doesn't like.
Those pesky Dracos.
Yeah, right? But what I'm getting at is we talk about reptilians and in some cases different types of species. But if we get past it all, like there is a possibility that we can all live together, right? We can all work together. We can all live together. And hopefully that can be done. It was done in Atlantis, the time we had Atlantis. It was like that before they started the war again. And who started the war again? The Draco again.
Those right? Pesky Dracos.
Exactly.
Right? So here's the thing. I mean, so you can see how this story all starts falling together. And then, like you're saying, you know, everybody's got a piece of the puzzle, because I didn't know about the destruction of Maldek until I saw that video with Simon Parks and Randy Kramer.
Yeah.
And they, very kind of, mentioned it. So I thought, oh, well, and that's why I got in touch with Simon Parks. I wanted to grill him about that. Tell me about the destruction of Maldek. So everybody I speak to is like, tell me about the destruction of Maldek and what you remember. You know, and I've spoken to people who were on the planet itself. I've heard from, people who have contacted the Bigfoot, who say they come from there, the Sasquatch people,
okay.
The hairy people come from planet Maldek because it's a water planet. And so hairy people kind of, and you know, they're like, thing. Anyway, it's like they live on the shore.
Well, they need to jump in the river once.
Yeah. Yeah. And you need hair if you're in the river because of the rocks, you know.
What?
So, yes. And, yeah, like John Titor was here saying, the Martian reptilians don't like the Dracos any more than we do. The Dracos attempted to trick the humans into thinking they and the Martian reptilians were one and the same. Yeah. So they're, you know, they're just very pesky. And, but like you say, everybody's going to glow with a particular color. And, at some point, everybody's going to go at some point. Is that right?
What, or maybe not.
What do you know about this like separation of two Earths, if at all? You know, like Dolores Cannon has been talking about, like some sort of mitosis thing, mitosis.
Yeah, I like Dolores Cannon. She leveled me out when she was alive with her videos because, as you said, when you fully awake or start to awake, it could grip you by the boo-boo really hard, right? So, people like Dolores Cannon and Jose Arguelles were people that I didn't know, but I heard of, and through their videos, they kind of grounded me. Another one was David Icke, Michael Tessarian's another one, right? And Dolores Cannon, very good person, very good heart, and, see, different timelines can present different things. And who's to say this is the only timeline, right? So in one timeline, it could be exactly like Dolores said. And in the other timeline, gee whiz, the Nazis could have won World War II and we'd be all speaking German, right? Or Chinese for that matter, right? So there's different timelines that present different possibilities. But what I told, or what I was taught through my discussions with Audrey said that what happens on Earth right now. And even Dan McMullen said this to me. Dan McMullen's kind of grounded me too, because sometimes I have my yaha moments where I'm kind of down and all that. Dan said, you know what? Live in the now. Live right now. Don't worry about what happened an hour ago. Live now. And I got in my head, okay, yeah, you're right. Okay. And I just put that memory out of my head and started living now. Okay. So that thing happened to me an hour ago. It wasn't exactly a cool thing. So let's make some other cool things like right now. And I just move on. So Audrey was saying what you do now right here on Earth affects all the other dimensions. So this is, it's like, you can't be sitting on the fence no more. You can't be saying, oh, I'll do that tomorrow. Right? And our buddy said, well, you can't, you know, just let it be. No, you gotta do something, right? Okay, maybe you're not working, but if you're not working, you can do other things. You could be doing what we're doing right now, be doing an interview on a computer. We could be on the computer. We could be educating. We could be posting stuff. We could be creating awareness. We can be volunteering. We can be doing good things for good people, right? Stuff like that. And so we can bring about a consciousness point. And if you tip the consciousness point, everything's...
Exactly. Absolutely. This is the theme of kind of Simon on my conversation earlier, when I was, you know, he was saying, you know, what's the point of, he was essentially saying, you know, I'm summarizing, I'm paraphrasing, let's say, like, you know, I could vote for, I could, you know, try and be prime minister, but then I'd have to go into politics and I hate that. Right.
Right.
That's what he said. Cause basically it's like, what's the point of going into that pile of toot? There's no point. The best thing is to create a new network, and that's what he's doing. So he's creating a new money, a form of exchange that, and I tell you, when you exchange with a tokenized system like this,
yeah,
it's joyous. It is really a joyous thing to do. It makes you happy to spend money, as it were.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And it educates you about what is the true nature of money? And the true nature of money is this your soul energy, which is a pure joy, pure love, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. So that's an hour of your time is like how much? Like $25, right? Whatever. That's an hour of your time. So when you spend $25, you know that I've spent an hour of my jolly time, and I'm going to spend it on this jolly, jolly little thing that I've got.
Sure.
You know, rather than thinking, oh, gold, you know, I can't pay the rent. And because the idea of paying the rent. So here's the thing. How do we move from our hierarchical society that we have now, where people are relying on a leader? This is why, you know, and the thing about a leader is you always kill him. You know, that's the nature of a leader. You always sacrifice the leader at the end of the story. It's never a good ending, is it?
Well, in a lot of people in Earth's history, it happened to, right? All the leaders like John Lennon, Gandhi, JFK, Martin Luther King, right? That seems to be the case in scenarios, right? Even some rock stars, if you want to go extend this further, right? But
it's the Wicker Man.
Yeah, a Wicker Man, unfortunately, yeah. But Ubuntu, have you heard of Ubuntu?
I rely on it, actually. No, well, there are several levels of it, and one of them is the operating system that I have been using for the last 6 years to broadcast Wolf Spirit Radio. I have to say, I'm very pleased with that level of Ubuntu. I'm also aware of Michael Tellinger's work, and
right.
the you know, yes, I completely understand it. It's, look, we all know what it is. Everybody's got a different name for it, and that's
yeah.
why people fight. But
okay.
we all know what we want. We all know that we don't want a hierarchical society. We don't
yeah.
want anybody telling us what to do with our time.
Yep. Yeah.
This is precious to us.
Yeah.
Right? Because we are creator beings. We also don't want anybody telling us to do with our thoughts. Yeah. We don't want, actually, now I'm going to be controversial here. We don't want Disney capturing our children's imagination. I want them to give it back, please.
That's
because
right.
That's what they're going to be used to create the world of the future. You know, much as Sean loves Disney, it captures your child's imagination. What's the worst thing you could imagine? Anyway, we're all looking for, our tribe, our clan, our community. And when Audrey started talking about these people are from this clan and these people are from that clan and they're on this planet, I thought, oh, you know, my tension released is that, there's a model. There is a model. And like you were saying before, it's very similar because it's the beginning of, it's the ancestor of the Native American way of elders and clans and stuff like that. So I think what we're going to be looking at is a kind of new clan connected consciousness society.
Yeah. Definitely. Now, I'm going to, here's an analogy I'm going to throw at you. We both like rock and roll.
Throw it, man, and I'll catch it.
All right. So Pink Floyd. You like Pink Floyd?
I know every note.
Okay. So I've never heard of a Pink Floyd concert since 1972 that's under like 50,000 people. Okay. They're always playing the biggest stadiums and it's always a good time and everybody's vibes really happy. And when you leave that concert, boy, oh boy, do you have a smile on your face and you just spent, $50 on whatever the ticket was and you're happy. You're like, wow, I had a great experience. The wow effect. Okay. Now grab that emotion that I just described. Now that euphoric rush feeling. Okay. Grab that. Now picture a Grateful Dead concert in the 80s when Jerry Garcia was still alive and 4 hours before the Dead are actually taking the stage. All you hear all around you is drumming, dancing, music. You're smelling barbecues. People are having a barbecue. There's people are offering beers. People are offering joints, whatever, right? Dancing going on and everybody's smiling. Everybody's happy. Everybody's in a good mood.
Mm-hmm.
No problems, no strife, nothing. All right? That right there is what the 60s were. And we still haven't lost it. But people just got to look around. Now you take that and you put it in the bush somewhere or a piece of land or anywhere. And everybody's happy. Everybody's co-creating. Look, I've got a terrible voice. Okay, so I won't sing. I'll do something else. I'll plant trees and I'll do a garden. All right. You might have
a
great drummer.
You can play drums, man.
Or I can make drums. Right. There you go. Right. You, on the other hand, you're a great musician. You can make the music. So while I'm planting the garden, you can be playing a song. And while everybody's hearing you play the song, the teacher could be teaching this and everybody be learning and doing their part. This is what the Pleiades, they do. This is what they said. And they don't got to work a lot. It's really like, you know, 2-3 hours a day, right? And if they want a day off, they take a day off, right? And everybody does their part. And when you work it out, it's like 20 hours a week, right? Doing what you want to do. It's not like, okay, I got to get a job and all of a sudden, you know what? I got a job and I'm the guy that goes in the sewers and cleans out the sewer because that's the job I got and that's the job I got, right? But it's not necessarily the job I want to do, right? But it's the job I got because I need to pay bills. But the Jimmy thought is, okay, you know what? Jimmy likes to do a garden or plant seeds or whatever. So you know what? Now I can pick my own job to do. And there's no obligations and there's no fuss about it. Right? Because I'm one of many doing the same job. And the job has to be done 24 hours a day, more or less. Right? This is how it operates down there in the Pleiades. Right? Everybody does their part. They have cafes like we have here, apparently, right? They don't eat a lot, not like we do here, right? Because the air is different. You actually don't even have to eat at all. You can just breathe in the air and that's your nutrients, right? But they eat out of pleasure, right? They'll go to a cafe and probably go on a date just like we do, right? That part hasn't changed.
Do they hold hands and feet?
You know what, Dave? I don't know. We'll have to ask Audrey. But that's a good, funny question we can ask him. I like questions like that because it brings a bit of laughter.
Yeah, because we do need a bit of laughter. I mean, considering a lot of the conversation of the day has been pretty, you know, it's been wide ranging, and we've touched on some, you know, pretty heavy and dark subjects. So it's very nice to bring love into it.
Getting back to Audrey, though,
mm-hmm.
You know he's over at Standing Rock. He's been there for about eight months now, eh?
That's
him and Dan. Now, when they first got there before the altercation at the camp, they were there for about a week before there was an altercation on the bridge. And during that week, that camp, they had about, a few thousand people there. And they had solar-powered stuff. They had inventions that were all green energy inventions. A lot of people were helping a lot of people out. They were camping. They were doing a lot of good things, and it was seen, right? And they had no electricity, but everybody was powering up everything with solar energy, wind energy, a lot of great things. And it was done in a relatively short amount of time. There was one guy even booging around in a car. He made a car, an electric car, on the spot, and he was zooming around the camp. So if they can do that in a little amount of time, imagine what we can do on Earth if we have the opportunity, right? And you know what's restricting us, JP?
JP Morgan.
No, JP, well, that's one of it. Part of the establishment. Part of the...
Yeah, exactly. The JP establishment. And the things. I mean, in a way, that's why I hold that name, you know, because it's another alternative JP that is not greedy and horrifically damaging to this this world.
See, I always thought it was because you take a lot of intermission breaks or whatever, right?
Well, indeed, and that is perfectly timed to take an intermission because some people must.
That's
and
true.
Some people must. And this is Must Must by Nusrat Fateh Ali Khan. And welcome back to Ever Beyond. It is midnight past five. Five past midnight here on Ever Beyond Radio on All Spirit Media Network. And my guest tonight is James Borg. Are you here, James?
Yes, I am.
You're back. Excellent. Fabulous. So, where were we and where should we go?
Wherever you want to lead it, JP.
Okay.
Take us on an experience, wherever you want to go.
So, here's the thing. You know, I was talking like, this is how I got here and that's how you got here. One thing that I was wanting to talk about is how, so this takes it all the way back, all the way back to the beginning of the conflict that the Lyrans got themselves into. And from what I can understand, when Audrey was talking about it, it spread. The shock of it spread throughout throughout the whole system, you know, instantly, and everybody felt the shock and the panic and everything like that. Do you have any recollection of that moment?
One of the earliest memories I'm one to believe in reincarnation, so I remember a lot of fragmented memories of my life here on Earth, many of them. One of my memories is being a boy, being taught outdoors and with a lot of flowers everywhere. and a lot of gardens and a lot of water and bridges. But they're like walking bridges and no vehicles of any sort that I knew of. And everybody was very, very happy. Everybody was in a good vibe. Again, that good vibe. So that was my earliest, well, I don't know if that's my earliest memory. It's a memory I have. I have another memory. It was actually done consciously. And I was daydreaming, and it just came to me there. I was walking on a pebble beach in what looked to be what I thought was the Arctic. And it was at nighttime, and where I was walking with two other people, and there were a lot of beings on the beach, and they were all grouped together with four or five people, six people, eight people. And they had, all of them had, the whole entire beach was lit up with fires, little bonfires. And again, everybody was peaceful. And this is what I, what looked, or what my intuition told me was the Arctic. So, you know, the Arctic, a lot of it now is, well, a lot of it's ice free now, but back in the day it was ice covered a lot. And, could it be what it was back then is what I'm having an experience of, or what I was daydreaming? Sometimes when you let yourself go, it's, you know, intuitive mind control that sets yourself free. Daydreaming's really good, actually, right? Daydreaming can go into a meditative state. Sometimes it just automatically. So you get memories like that. That was one of my memories. So I have a lot of these memories. As far as O'Leara, Audrey's told me, you were one of us. He goes, I wouldn't be here. And, you know, I'm here now and my clan's coming together, so to speak. All right. And I said, well, what was I doing when it happened on Atlantis? And he says, you're a librarian, what we call a librarian. And you are more concerned about getting a lot of people evacuated. And when push came to shove, you didn't take the shove and you were pushing everybody to get on ships. And then when it actually happened, it was unbearable because you tried to evacuate as many people as you could and you stayed behind. And then when I stayed behind, I had a death caused by a sonic sound cannon, like they have now in Dakotas there in the Standing Rock. They have a sound cannon, right? But this sound cannon was so strong that it liquefied your brain. It turned your brain into mush, and it came out your ears. And that's how I died, apparently. On Atlantis, when we had Atlantis, or Atlantia, as a lot of Palladians call it, Atlantia. We call it Atlantis, they say Atlantia.
It's interesting the names that things are given, isn't it?
It is.
And you think, well, here I am on Earth, right? I look up at the sky and I see this little cluster. And we call that the Pleiades group. And then I look over there and I see this other cluster and I call that the Ursa Major group. And I look up there, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. But we look up at Lyra and we see a lyre, you know, a guitar, you know, a harp thing.
Okay. Yep.
You know. But from Lyra, it doesn't look like itself a harp. It does. This is some, you know, one of the questions that I've always had is like, how come things are named the way they are? And perhaps they're not named the way they are, but with, like you just said, you know, the Pleiadians call Atlanteans, you called it Atlantia, which makes sense if, you know, rather than Atlantis, you know, that sounds like a Greek ending, doesn't it?
Yeah.
And, So the Pleiadians call themselves, you know, actually, Audrey says the Pleiades, doesn't he? He emphasizes the Pleiades, the third syllable.
True.
And, there are all these slightly different pronunciations that, yeah, right. And, you know, and there's his name and these other names, they're very Roman sounding, aren't they? Like Adrius is a very Latin sounding word.
It is.
You know,
it's also, they have a lot of the names start with the letter A, right? His wife's name is Arianas, right? And I don't know why that is. It's just the way it is, I guess. What he said, that it had something to do with emotion or the way you feel. So it's the way you feel is which becomes your name. So here's where it involves a lot of science where I'm not very good at. So if you were to measure at an emotion in a scientific way, which I don't think Earth technology has the capabilities to do so, it would make a phonic sound. And that phonic sound of the emotion of who that person is becomes your name. That's how I believe the names are given out. Which was, that in itself is really...
The sound I just made.
Yeah.
So, and here's the thing, because I spent the first like 5 minutes of my interview with him, how do you pronounce your name? Because I can hear everybody saying that and they're saying it wrong. You know,
it's a tongue twister.
Because they were saying that everybody's calling him Audrey, right? Which is a girl's name.
Well, that's could be my fault too, because that's the easiest way to call him, right? Because let's face it, he's got a lot of, in our vocabulary, he's got a lot of letters, and it's not a name like George or Joe or James, right? It's actually, you know, you got to be careful pronouncing it. It's Audrey Ewis, right? So the best way to write it out so you can pronounce it is write it out phonically rather than try to figure out what the actual alphabeticized letters are, right? Because, you know, it's nice to pronounce his name the proper way, right?
Here's another one.
Okay.
Pleiadian sister in the chat room is saying her name is Arona. Ah are the women. Ad are the men.
There you go.
So now, but also you're saying another thing is that the feeling. Okay. So here's the correct syllable. The correct syllable is the sound that you make when you have an aha moment. Ah.
Right.
Ah, Dreyus. And then the name sounds ah, Dreyus. Ah, between you and me.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there's a connection. Aha. You're giving me the aha moment between you and me.
There you go.
There you go.
All right.
So. And, Pleiadian sister's name is Arona.
It's a nice name.
Mm. So, so there we go. So Ard and Arn and, there you go. I always wonder what my name is, because I've never quite figured out. I mean, these other people call me Primus, but, that's something else. But, okay. I still don't know, like, I haven't been introduced to my Lyran self, like, face to face. I only see it from the inside out so far. It's quite an interesting thing. And it's a very distant connection. Anyway, I hope to make more connections with it. And I believe that making connections with people like yourself and others who are starting to have this hockey stick of memory recapitulation of remembering who you are, getting your head back.
Okay. Yeah. That's a good one. Yeah.
And you see, here's the thing, right? We know we're wiped. All right. Take that as a granted. So then, we know that there are also tricksters who are going to come along and say, oh, I know who you are. You know, and, you know, they take you right up down the country path and back.
Yeah.
You know, I know who you are, and you owe me.
beware the bearers of false gifts.
Yeah. So, and then there's people that you just have a feeling of like, oh, I feel for this person. I don't know why, but I just got this feeling of like, if he's sad, I'll feel sad. If he's happy, I'll feel happy. You know, there's this resonance with them. And this, I believe, is what is happening more and more. And these people are your clan. And they're also on the same mission. And this is the unnamed, the unspoken mission that we're all here doing, which yep. is the mission of beingness, because we have no word for it yet, because we haven't experienced it firsthand. Do you understand what I'm saying?
I understand completely what you say, right? And there's a lot of restrictions. Like, you know, what gives somebody the right to tell JP that he can't go to Australia tomorrow? If JP wants to go to Australia tomorrow, it's on the planet. He should be allowed to go.
Exactly.
Right? But no, because JP doesn't have a passport. He's got to apply for a passport, and that's going to take 4 weeks or 3 weeks or whatever it takes. And it's going to cost X amount of money. And he has to take a picture. And he might have to do this. And he might have to produce other ID, right? So, I mean, JP couldn't really take a trip to Australia tomorrow if he didn't have a passport.
That's right.
So this is what I don't like about civilization here on Earth. And up there, you know, Audrey said up there to go to one planet to another planet. In some cases, it takes like, you know, 10 minutes or 15 minutes or something like around that time period. So the time it takes for you and me to go in our car and go to the grocery store is the time it takes them to go to another planet, right? In their system and with no restrictions. And the vehicles they have, we have cars up there. It's like the Jetsons. They have vehicles and their smallest vehicle is interplanetary. How do you like that one? Right? So, I'll give you an example. A Volkswagen Bug, or Beetle, right? The hippies in the 60s, the Volkswagen, right? Okay, so we have this Volkswagen car, and, to them it's a vehicle. It's a two-seater, vehicle that they use for their own personal use, the citizens on the planet. But yet it can travel to Earth. Might take them a little longer than an estimated time of a faster ship.
But the trouble is, if they came to Earth today, as Audrey and Ariane House did, they would get shot down.
They would, right? And here's another one for you. Here's in the ufology community, there's a couple pet peeves I have. One of them is this, and it comes a lot from the disclosure movement people. I'm just going to call it like it is. But not so much Stephen Bassett. Because Stephen Bassett I hold in high esteem here. But everyone else. Okay, so when I'm going to say this, I'm not referring to anything that Stephen Bassett said. Because I agree with a lot of what he says. But everyone else, there's issues I have. And it comes from the disclosure movement. They always say, well, you know, we need these aliens to land on the White House lawn, right? These aliens or alien or E.T. Well, so there again, they always talk in a singular E.T. They want E.T. to land on the White House lawn. Well, hang on a second here. How dumb can you really be? If you look at Earth and you look at all the flora, all the fauna, all the mammals, all the reptiles, all the birds, all the life on the planet, they all can be considered earthlings, and it's plural. So when you say earthlings, you're actually identifying quite a lot of species on the planet. All right? So don't say I want E.T. to land on the White House lawn, because you got to be careful what you wish for. Now, that's just one planet on Earth. There's a lot of planets out there. All right? So identify who you're talking to. You want the Arcturians to land? Okay. You want the Andromedans? Okay. You want the Pleiades? Okay. Right?
Being more specific, yeah.
Be more specific.
But here's the thing. you know, it's not that they've landed on, there's thousands of them underneath the White House lawn. That's the tricky bit.
Here's, that's another one too. And they also, the White House is a no-fly zone. So before you talk, do some research, okay? You want them to land on the White House lawn and no-fly zone. Come on, right? They're gonna be shot at right off the bat.
Yeah, they might have one of those bug zapper laser things as well.
Exactly, right? And here's another ticket too. With every race of species, okay, you got good and you got bad. Audrey's told me some stories, not many times, but they're, you know, they were not so nice, Palladians that thought they can do things, a bit differently, and they broke off, right? And apparently they had something to do with the moon. Okay, or something like that. Correct me if I'm wrong, Audrey, if you see me, hear me. But, it had something to do with the moon. And, it's not that far away off from what's happening on Earth right now with DARPA and Black Ops projects and the scientists that work for these companies. Right? They're doing things on Earth that most of the citizens have no idea about, but can affect the planet. So in my opinion, yeah, we should be knowing about it because it's affecting us, right? We should have a say, right? And anyway, getting back to these small crafts, I had a visit, me and my wife, when it was in 2002. It was the closest UFO sighting I ever had. And it was a very small craft. It was an egg-shaped craft. It was all neon green. And it had a brown, chestnut brown windshield, or what looked like a windshield, but I couldn't see through. JP, this thing hovered about 5 to 10 feet above our heads. I can take my cigarette pack, fling it, and hit it. All right? And it had no noise. It hovered in because we were French kissing by a fire. We had a couple moments of,
And you're a babe magnet. James is a babe magnet, and you know, obviously he drew. But James, I just want to ask: at this moment, this thing is hovering above you.
Yeah.
Have you changed how you're feeling? What is the feeling that you get when this thing is above you?
That was the most amazing experience. Now here's the thing. It was preordained, JP.
The thing is what I'm listening for.
Yeah, it was the day it happened, we were at the cottage up north and we had a lot of people up at the cottage. We're having like a friendly group gathering. There was about maybe 11 people there, including my wife. My best friend was there with his wife and his firstborn child. We had a couple psychics up there. So I have a lot of friends that are all intuitive. We keep the close circles. And I was a ghost hunter back then as well, parapsychologist or whatever. And they wanted to hear ghost stories. I completely shunned them, and I was acting weird. And what they were saying was I was going back and forth on the shoreline to the dock. I was drinking beer and looking at the sky for like hours. It was like I was hypnotized. And I was remarking to them, look at that. I was pointing the things in the sky, which they couldn't really see. And then I came back to the fire. I sat down. We kind of had a few beers and relaxed. And here's the topper of it all, was when they all went upstairs to roll a couple homemade cigarettes, which left me and my wife alone. We had one of those aha romantic moments where we were just French kissing. And that's when it came in. And it came in with no sound. And how I noticed is when we were embracing, you know how they say you see things at the corner of your eye? Well, for us, it was from the top of our eyes. We seen it. And as soon as we seen us, look, I just had enough time to go, look. And just when I got that word out, look, this thing shot up like you wouldn't believe. I don't know how fast it was, but it was the fastest thing I seen in my life. It was 1 second, it was beyond the stars, and you could see it move like a flash, bang. And again, no sound. Years later, I asked Audrey, I said, what was that I seen? Was it you guys? He goes, yeah. He goes, we were just checking up on you. He goes, that was their, very basic, smallest crafts that we have. That's usually what we use when we travel on the planet, like what you guys call cars. That's what we have up there. And it was not as, like, it was, wasn't as big. It was just about the same size as like a Volkswagen Bug or a Beetle, right? And just something that small to their standards can do that distance in space-time travel. Right? So that's kind of, and the moment I felt was euphoric, JP. It changed me from that point on. When I was basically into, studying about the occult, magic, witchcraft, murder cases, ghost experiences, hauntings, anything paranormally related. After that, it's like, you know what? Screw this. I'm going to be a ufologist, right? This is where it's at, right? And another thing that happened too while I was a ghost hunter or a parapsychologist, a couple of the investigations we did, they weren't ghosts at all. It was gray related, right? Because don't forget, grays can, you know, pop in and pop out, phase in and phase out. Other entities can do that too, that are alien as well. And so a lot of times, and you come from a haunted area too in Scotland where you're living, a lot of people might think it's a haunting. It could very well be a haunting, but it could be a haunting of a different sorts. And how I found out was one day we took a picture, and my colleague at the time got it on digital. And this was the transition time when we were going from 35 millimeter film to digital. And at that time, to own a digital camera, just a very basic one, cost like $800. And I think he had an Olympus, photo. So it was just a basic digital. But at that point, when you took a picture, you could actually see it, you know, a second or two later on the digital screen, what you took a picture of. And that's when we seen the gray, when we snapped the picture. I was like, wow, right? And then that me basically took my whole focus of attention into the alien related side of things, into ufology. And then I got ridiculed, I got spammed, trolled, everything, because now I'm talking about all these experiences that I'm having, and everybody's pissing down my neck, right? Which might be the wrong person you want to piss down the neck, because, you know, I was the type of guy, you know, if you give me a little elbow, I'm going to elbow you back, right? I had a little mean streak at the time, too, back then. So, I mean, I wasn't, what I'm trying to say, if you hit me in the chin, I'd hit you back pretty quickly, too, right? Again, I guess that comes from maybe my roots, right?
Believing in super soldier.
Well, you know, it's not that far off from Duncan O'Finnian. God rest his soul, too. He's recovering in hospital. Duncan is Scottish Indian. So I have Scottish roots. I also have Scandinavian roots. The name Borg is actually a Scandinavian surname. It's a bit of royalty in the Vikings. The first Viking king in Denmark, his name was Borg. And I think in Denmark, I think the actual king and queen is named Borg, still to this day. And so there's one that the Illuminati might be afraid of, right? Here's a guy like me, an occult researcher, pretty adept at all types of subjects on the occult, good and bad, can handle himself in a fight, knows martial arts, knows how to fight, not afraid to fight, can fire a small arm firearm really, really good, and I mean a shitty gun at that, all right? So imagine what I could do with a good gun. Can throw a knife pretty good, can hit a bolt, like take a bow and arrow and hit a bullseye, whatever you want me to shoot at. You basically pick it and I'll hit it. Smells, I could smell in the forest. I mean, I got an amazing keen scent of smell, like a wolf-like smelling ability. So I could sense things, right? I can sense danger, right? So you get a guy like me, I now present a clear present threat to anybody in an Illuminati, all right? Because now not only can I got these capabilities, but I could also think the way they do. So I can get the group out of danger, right, at any given moment. Anyway, I don't mean to ramble on, but it's just the way it is, right? So maybe there's other people there. Sorry to interrupt you. Maybe there's other people there listening, right? That are also like us, right? Like the Duncan O'Finians and the Brad McBullens of the world, right? And, or even that they weren't even an MK Ultra projects, but a guy like me that were just keen to a lot of stuff, right? But have these characteristics. These people are very adaptable too to have in your circles because they're the people that protect the people. And I'm not saying that they're necessarily a leader, but they can help diffuse things.
And, no, they're in service. It's all about service. Nobody becomes a leader. That's the thing. It's exactly. All a circle, which is the original word that meant that has become the word today's church is kirk, right? Kirk, circle, you see?
Okay.
Church, kirk, circ, circle, you see? Same word.
Okay.
And so the idea of, you know, a church is a group of people sitting equally in a circle.
Which is fantastic.
You see? And that's what we do when we sit around the fire.
Yeah.
You know, there's no better place or worse place. There is the place for everybody.
Yeah, that's right.
And that's exactly. So that's where we want to go, really. I think back towards that egalitarian, having and you know, it's basically the end of dominance. I'm fed up with dominance. I'm fed up with people telling me what to do. Nobody, not even me, tells me what to do.
Oh, it's insane.
Yeah.
I knew a guy. He was, here you go. When I started Euphoria, which was a meetup group in Canada, was to meet up people like me that had UFO experiences and sightings. And then in walked in a person that was Department Zero. He was a Canadian that's an implant from Romania. And he was no different than Duncan O'Finian when he got to know him. And he started telling me his life story. He had the ability to have, he has the psychokinetic gift. Right, so he can actually move things with his mind. And so what happened when he was 7 years old, he was in the forest and he was making rocks float. And then he was showing his mom and dad. And this is communist Romania back, you know, 30, 40 years ago. So when they seen their son moving rocks and floating pencils in the air, they made an appointment with the doctor really quick. And the doctor gave the guy a pen to move on his desk, and sure enough, he floated in the air. Well, the doctor promptly called the government, and the next day the government came to take my friend away. And then he started to stay in a government compound. It was like a big school, but it had everything in a school. Bunk beds, sleeping quarters, restaurants, a workout room, schools. And they did tests with this guy. And so he became like the Romanian version of what you might call a super soldier here. And not only he passed with flying colors, a lot of other kids didn't. They died because some of the tests they do are life-threatening tests. And then to make a long story short, they taught him how to be a nuclear physicist. And he was also a paranormal investigator like I am, but working for a shoot of the government called Department Zero, which is part of the Romanian government at that time. And even back in the day, he goes, even Russia depended on Department Zero, right? And he was telling me stories that were, you know, kind of freaky stories about things that he's seen. Cause they have the Bucci Mountains there and they got a Carpathian Pass. It's kind of in the area. You're talking Vlad the Impaler, all that area, right? That's all kind of really, really paranormal lands and a lot of things happen.
Transylvania.
Yeah. So there's a lot of legends, a lot of lores, a lot of myths, a lot of everything, right? And, bottom line, it's like very haunted, right? Like very haunted.
dark, 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 dark. So there's obviously some ETs, some, not very nice, ET entities down there, probably in the cabins below the mountains.
Yeah, definitely. And you know, here's the thing about Scotland, because I got ancestry in Scotland too. And you're in Scotland now.
I am in the Highlands.
I in the Highlands, one of the best places to be in Scotland. So now, when you look at vampiristic stuff, all right? So you're talking Dracula, Vlad the Impaler, right? What do they call him? They call him Dracula, all right? Dracula, right? Okay, so now, in Scotland, in around 10 AD, there was the influx of black magic, all right? And that's when you had a lot of the noble people were actually playing around with black magic, all right? And then you had the Zoroaster religion come across, right? The Baphomet symbol and everything else. But it was tied to bloodletting and sacrifice and gothic stuff at that time. And when you look at the Baphomet symbol, it sort of looks like a Dracula, or what they called a demon at the time, all right? Demon, Dracula. You put two pictures of two drawings of what both people are interpreting, a demon, and someone else is calling a Dracula. They're the same thing, just drawn by different artists.
All right? You know, I think it's something that is burned into the descendants of Lyrans. It's burnt into the DNA. It's like, here's another thing, James. You've been around studios and stuff. There's one thing that is really uncomfortable in a studio, and that's trailing wires. Not just because you're likely to pull them up with your shoes and trip over and destroy someone's $600 guitar, but
yeah.
There is, and I do it because when I tidy up the cables on the floor and order them, the place feels a lot less anxious. It feels like there are no snakes in the room.
Okay,
so again, going back to this idea of demons and Dracos being more or less the same thing, I'll take those odds.
Yep. Definitely. And here, what were they all doing back in those days? They were bloodletting, right? There was, Dracula was drinking blood, or a lot of blood involved, a lot of blood gore, right? Even if you go back into the Mayan civilization, right? The very first evidences of the Maya culture, for the first 300 years, they were not bloodletting. They didn't have sacrifices. And then something changed. They were introduced to something. Man, if you walk to Chichen Itza, which is a very famous site in Mexico, not too far away from Cancun, a couple hour drive. That site's riddled with carvings of snakes and all sorts of reptile figures, right? They even had a game where they played a ball court game. I wasn't sure if it's the winner or the loser. I would imagine it's the loser. If you lost the game, you're sacrificed, right? And then they had the pyramid there where, when you climb the pyramid, it's supposed to be, you're going to see the god, right? But the thing is, when you get to the top, they're also going to rip out your heart and sacrifice you to the god, right? So it's like, whoa, right? Very goristic, very gory stuff. But what did they do? They left the heart and the organs open as a sacrifice. You know, the next day, all that stuff was gone, eh? There was no hearts remaining. There was no sacrifice. They had to do another sacrifice the next day. Who ate it? I don't know. Was it vultures? I don't know. Was it vultures all the time? I don't know. But I do know they sacrificed a lot of people. What's the reason behind this? What's the reason why they had snake carvings on their pyramids? And places that they had in the village there. Everywhere you went was depictions of snakes. Right? So it's like, wow, right? It's mind boggling, this blood gore, bloodletting. It's like we've been corrupted. And we weren't corrupted early in the beginning. It was like a gradual thing, right? once we had the invention of the sword and iron and we started making knives, then it sort of happened, right? Don't forget the Mayans were probably one of the first when it came to manufacturers of the knife. Now, their knives were made out of obsidian, which is a volcanic rock that's very sharp. It's almost like a glass-like rock that you couldn't really break. It's also a hard stone, right? But again, when they it was after they had the knife, then they came to this bloodletting stuff, right? It's almost like they were corrupted. I'm going to just say plain flat out, if there was anything like a creation of Lucifer or the devil or Satan, it's like he presented himself to these people in different times of history and said, do it this way and I'll reward you, right? This has happened to the Maya. This happened to in Scotland in 10 AD. This happened in Romania. It happened in Italy, right? All throughout the histories, you see evidences of this stuff, right? And it's a corruption. The whole world we live in is a corruption. It's, they say the whole world's a lie. And you know what? The deeper you go, the deeper you read, mark my words, it is.
All right, get this. I mean, today, there's a revelation. All right?
Okay.
Because we have been lied to about one of the most important fundamental things. We have been lied to. They say, they have told us that gravity is a sucky force that drags us down to the planet. Today, Simon Park said, gravity, as was explained by his mantid people to him,
okay,
is a wave that is generated by the result of light hitting our atmosphere, and we are pressed down like bugs on a windscreen.
Ah, there you go. Amazing, eh?
And the bigger the planet, the higher the gravity, which is why when the planet was smaller, there was less atmosphere, and that the dinosaurs could grow large. They couldn't do that today. They'd fall over.
Yeah.
So, you see the whole thing about gravity and levity? See, one of the reasons that I wanted to, that I asked that very specific question about how did you feel? You know, take a little breath here, James, right? Take a breath through your nose, right?
Oh yeah.
Because if you go back to that moment, I mean, there was a feeling. Obviously, you were in a very joyful place. You have, you're having a, a nice encounter. And then you're having close encounters the first, second, third, fourth, and fifth time. Fifth kinds. And the thing about the gravitational propulsion systems of these things is that gravitons are levitons. Okay? Now, mm-hmm. I want to blow everybody's mind, all right? Because this is gonna, all right. So, a bumblebee. You know, they say, you always hear this old saw that says, a bumblebee should, by gravity, by science, shouldn't be able to fly. You know, and that's true. They cannot explain how these little tiny little wings lift and propel this enormous big fluffy thing.
Okay.
All right. But the truth is that the bee levitates, right? The sound it makes is the frequency of joy, which makes him float. And the little wings are like the propellers on a blimp. They're just for steering.
Wow.
So they don't have to be so huge. However, a wasp is a mean, hungry, hard-working, grafty machine.
Mm.
That's why it's got great big wings, because it is flying. Right? It's like a jet plane. It's beautiful. You know, if you look at a wasp or a hornet, it's just so, they're like purely manufactured little Nissan cars. You know. There's Audrey.
Bring on Audrey.
Let's see. Can we, let's bring an interesting conversation to talking about. So let's talk gravitons for the last 10 minutes. If we can, bring Mr. R.
Mr. Odd.
Audrey, hi, how are you?
How are you?
We're great. Lovely to see you. Look at you. Yeah, we were talking about bees, levitation, gravitons. Have we got it? Do we have it? Do we have this consciousness, bro?
Let me stop the broadcast on Wolf Spirit Radio. There we go. Just having a hard time hearing you under the sound of the broadcast.
Oh, sorry, I was bombarding you. Yes. So, yes, the conversation is about bees, gravity, levity. How far and the little egg-shaped Pleiadian craft that are used as a personal transportation. Do you have any comments on that?
Well, I was listening to you talk about gravity and your theory about how light presses everything down to the ground here. That is not entirely far from the truth. In fact, what you have is photoradionic energy. You have a difference between quarks in negative phase and quarks in positive phase, which attract like magnets. So every planet and every star has a center of quarks in negative phase, negative frequency. And what this does is it attracts quarks vibrating in higher frequency, in this case photons, to attract to the object of which surrounds the center point of negative phase. So in a star, you have a black hole at the very center. You have constant explosions, combustion, which keeps the positive phase atmosphere pushing outwards as it's attracting inwards, which keeps the star in check. So the same thing applies to a planet. You have a center of negative phase quarks, usually high density quarks. It can be either at the center or it can be within the inner shell. And this creates the illusion of gravity. Electromagnetic energy in this case, in this planet where you have two shells that are grinding at different speeds and they create an electromagnetic pole at the same time that you have a center of gravity, as you call it, center of gravity, quarks in negative phase. So this creates gravity as people know it. It holds everything in place. Remember that every atom has quarks within the nuclei of the atom, and all of those quarks can be in negative phase or in positive phase. It can also be neutral phase. Does this make sense?
So how does that connect with the atomic number of any atom and the geometric structure of its nucleus?
It has to do with the number of quarks within the nucleus of the atom. And that also determines how many protons, neutrons, and electrons that will be attracted to that. Those protons, neutrons, and electrons are made of photoradionic waves in different frequencies and combinations.
Yeah, that's where it gets weird. When things start becoming particles and then they start out as waves and then they become particles and then, what is the whole thing about particles and waves? And there's a nature that is neither particle nor wave or both, or, you know, what's the deal? Can you shed some light on that paradox?
It's all energy. Everything is energy. Everything flows through everything else. Everything has attractions. Everything is diamagnetic or it's magnetic. In this universe, everything is made of the same thing. So where you have positive quarks and positive phase, which are in high frequency, the higher the frequency of those quarks, the brighter they glow, creating the illusion of light. You also have on the opposite end of the spectrum, quarks in negative frequency, so dark you cannot see them. They're out of your perceptible range. So this is what people refer to as dark matter. What happens when these quarks collide? The frequencies don't dissipate, they equalize, which creates a neutral frequency depending on how high or low either side was when they collided. And it may appear that they disappear, but matter's not lost in this universe. Nothing is ever destroyed. Things are transferred. Energy is transferred, balanced or misbalanced.
Wow.
Hey, James, you're back.
I'm back. I was just listening. When Audrey talks, I kind of listen because it's like I'm in school again. So I don't want to interrupt my lesson here because I need to learn too.
Absolutely. Absolutely. It's a comfortable position. I was wondering about this as well earlier. You know, is this a familiar position to you, Audrey, to be talking to James and myself like this?
Yes, it's very familiar.
Because we were, we were talking about Lyra and places before. And also something that I was, was going to bring up, and here you are, in the months that we've gotten to know each other, one of the things when you first started out, you were saying we really must get together and have an Ubuntu society and Ubuntu, and we know that. Yeah. And then, wham! There you are, and it's manifested before you. That must have been quite a feeling.
Well, it was an amazing feeling coming here to Standing Rock and seeing the people that were trying to live without money, that were trading and bartering, living within their means and trading as they needed, and producing free energy, producing goods and materials and, you know, creating things, people that were imagining, people that were manifesting what can be into what is. You know, we created a society here that is now changing the world, but this is the first example of that I've seen in a very long time in the United States, and this is by far the largest example the United States has ever seen, aside from prior to 1492 when the natives here were living in a free society anyway. So trading and bartering as they needed, living within their means. You know, so they had a society before, long before the United States. And seeing that again, seeing the people get together and work together as a united front, you know, here in the United States is very humbling. Now, I'm speaking of this in past tense, although these camps have not ended. They've just, the people have moved around the United States. You know, a lot of the people I've been tracking from the camps are now between about 250 camps, and currently we have Flint, Michigan. Camp Promise is, you know, they're fighting for their land. You know, their water is completely polluted, and, you know, they're living in slums out there, and they're trying to fight to get their land back and to prevent them from being evicted. So them being the people that live there. So anyway, out here at Standing Rock, you know, watching these camps grow, watching these camps flourish and people working together to make this a reality was by far one of the most humbling things I've seen in the United States up to this date in a very long time. So I was very impressed to see people really trying to break away from the government, you know, mind control system, you know, that they were trying to fight against the mind control system that has been in place for over 500 years, starting back in 1492 on these lands here when, you know, Columbus and, you know, came in to take over the land. You know, Columbus is really not a name that the natives like so much for many reasons that people have been terribly misformed about in the history of the United States. You know, he was a rapist, he was a murderer, you know, a pedophile among many things, and raped and killed many Native Americans here. So you know, this is how the Native Americans see the United States. You know, what we're trying to do is to, you know, create a society where everybody can live in balance without a mind control system, to create an Ubuntu society where everybody can live freely, where everyone can live without money. And as I said before, the camps here, this is the first example I've seen of people attempting to do just that. So we didn't need money within the camps. We didn't need anything outside of our means. We just lived very simply. We sat around the campfires. We sat around the sacred fire. We prayed. We sung. We danced. We had a wonderful time. It was a magical experience. And for all of you out there that may have not had the opportunity to come to these camps up here, there are still many around the United States. You know, you got them as far south as Florida. You got them in Texas, Arizona, Illinois, Iowa, Wisconsin, Missouri, Michigan. You got camps everywhere. So, you know, South Dakota still has a couple. You know, we have Prairies Camp down there. We have Eagle Butte. We still have one camp up here that's operational here in North Dakota, and that is the Four Band Cheyenne River Camp up on the 1806 just past the pit stop. That camp is more of an educational camp now. Johnny Bisaggio runs that camp. And he formed that camp just to teach people about the culture, to teach them how to survive in the winter, how to build tents, how to, you know, establish free energy, and, you know, just to generally educate the people on what we did up here. So I find frequently that people still come to the Sacred Stone area where I'm at right now, and they ask for a tour of the camp, or what used to be the camp over here. So every once in a while, I'll give the people a tour, walk them down and show them where everything used to be, and talk about the society we had. You know, show them where we used to have our communions, where we used to sit at the sacred fires, and show them how life used to be. So we had a wonderful time.
Audrey?
You know, go ahead.
James, it's we're out of time here. It's fabulous to have you back on. Will you be around next week for your regular show? Excellent. That's great. Audrey Ewers, now we heard James was talking about how we pronounce your name, and it's the R of the aha. Ah.
Yes.
You can feel the heart opening when you say ah. It's not, because people call you Audrey, which is not your name.
No, but it's easy for them to say. That's why we use that as a nickname.
Yeah. But, Audrey Ewers, James Borg, thank you. This has been, very beyond ever beyond.
Thank you.
Thank you. Good night.
Thank you so much.
Beyond.